So I realize that you know, the reason you guys really come to these is that you really want the tips and tricks. You don't really you like the project to see what's going on, but you really don't care about that. But I'm still going to tell you about the project a little bit, and then we'll move forward and into sort of some of the tips and tricks and things that our team has learned along the way. So to introduce our project, it's called Clean Water 3: Reduce, Remediate, Recycle, Enhancing Alternative Water Resource Availability and Use to Increase Profitability in Specialty Crops. This project was funded in 2014, and so we've just entered our fourth year of the project. And I have to say, I have the best team to work with you could possibly imagine. So they make my life as a project director easy, and I could not ask for anything more than that. And we have great PIs and great students and also research assistants and other things along those lines that help actually make this project feasible and workable. So we have 21 co-PIs on the project at 10 institutions, and we cover the gamut from sociology and economics to environmental toxicology and plant physiology. So this is a big project with a very transdisciplinary or interdisciplinary team. And then really the people who make our project work are the students and the research assistants and the technicians in the field. I mean, we're there for the mentoring and guidance. We're helping train that next generation of scientists that are actually going to make a difference for our nursery and greenhouse growers. And I think that's probably going to be one of the biggest outputs from this, is that continued academic knowledge, along with the technologies to help save growers money, because that's the whole point, which I'll show. We also have 11 grower collaborators. So we have nurseries and greenhouses who have allowed us to work at their facilities. They work with us. They help us install treatment technologies, and I'll get to talk about a few of those. They let us help them design recycling systems for their operations. And without our growers, none of this matters, because we're fortunate to work with some of the more forward-thinking growers who are very interested in adopting newer technologies. And this helps us, because they are serving as that example for the rest of the growers who will look at them and say, hey, oh, they're doing it. It must be something that was worthwhile. Or what was good, what was bad about what we're doing. So the goal of our project is to ensure that water does not limit grower economic sustainability. So we want to help them develop conservative use practices, or how they actually use water. We want to help them mitigate environmental impact, because as we move forward and population growth occurs, and we also have urban centers encroaching on what were rural areas, there is going to be competition and there are going to be greater concerns over how we use water, so it's very important. And we also want to help them develop these viable alternative water resources, because without viable alternatives, they're just going to go out of business. So if we can help them develop these technologies, we are helping our industry maintain their economic viability. So our objectives are to develop an online or develop online decision support tools that help growers with understanding and adopting recycling technologies. One of the things that we heard, and we had a planning grant that actually helped us develop this proposal, was that there's a lot of information out there, but it's all in disparate places and they can't actually find it. So they're often paralyzed into inaction and can't make decisions because they don't know what decision to make. And that's also making a decision. So we're putting all of these resources into a single place, so that we can help our growers reduce irrigation and reduce contaminant loading into water. We want to help them identify the treatment technologies that will actually work for them, and we also want to effectively communicate our outcomes to them so that they're actually used. So this is a project that is heavily focused on actually developing something that growers will adopt. And to sort of set the stage, as it were, we sort of have about four different main thematic areas within our project. We have understanding the system, then we have reduce, remediate, and recycle. And then laid over all of these is actually outreach. Because within all of these components, outreach is the thing that makes it work, makes it worthwhile. Without it, it's nothing. We can do all the best work in the world, but if we're not actually getting it out there and getting people to use it, why did we do it? So when we talk about understanding the system, there's a few things that are really exciting that we've started to develop. So we have two collaborators, one in Michigan and one in Virginia, who have actually installed nursery pads where we can actually determine how much water leaches through ground cloth and underneath and runs off, and then that which runs off the surface of production areas. Before this, we had no clue how much water was actually lost. I think most of us would have guessed that the majority was actually surface runoff, and it's actually not. So that's going to be very helpful in the future of how we design systems and things. How does water move in substrates? Our containers are black boxes that we haven't really understood. We know we can grow wet, we can grow dry, but how does water move? How does a container dry out over time? How can we tell how a container grows out, dries out? And you'll notice occasionally I have little call-out boxes in the top right corner. Those are other talks from this project throughout the rest of the week, or sometimes they've already occurred this morning. But so one of our critical components is actually the barriers to adoption, or how we get growers to use technology. Some of it is helping us understand how to present information, and some of it is helping us get growers to talk to each other about what they're doing. And we're developing cognitive maps and other ways of looking at it so that we can actually present information in a way that'll be effective and actually encourage adoption. We're also looking at what do consumers perceive about water. Because if we can convince consumers, or if consumers are willing to pay more for a container that was grown using water conservation-based practices, it's well worthwhile, because if you can get 2 cents more per container or can from a yard, that's actually a decent amount of profit for our growers. And it depends on where you are regionally in the country as to whether that is likely to occur or not. Then we're also looking at the economics of production practices and also the economics of changing practices. And intrinsic to this is our life cycle assessment, where we're actually performing carbon footprint analysis and water footprint analyses. And what's interesting about these graphs are small, you know, a little difficult to read, and, you know, a good expose on this would take, you know, 20 minutes to get you up to speed. But in reality, we learn which factors are the most important. And if we want to change something that will influence carbon sequestration or water use, we know which factors are the most important, and we can target those. So that's where we're helping our growers know where, if they make a change, it will make the most impact. So when we talk about reduce, we can talk about it in a few ways, whether we're talking about engineering substrates for better water relations, actually understanding how particle size influences how water moves through a container, or whether it's potentially some of these substrate amendments, whether it's peat moss or core, because some of them work better as a bridge within the pot to help move water in the container when it's drier than others. These are all critical factors that we haven't understood before, but we're beginning to understand, which will actually help us help growers use water better. And then if we look at optimizing water use, because if we apply less water or apply water when it's needed, less of the water runs off the operation, which also means that we have less contaminants or fewer contaminants that we actually need to manage. You know, if you look at the right side of the screen, you know, we saved 6% of the water in June, 22% in July, 8.5% in August, and wow, we used 13.5% more water when we had sensor-based control versus grower-based control. But guess what? That's when the plants needed the water, so we're giving them more water when it's needed. So it's really understanding the system and getting a better, just holistic sense, and this is information that are very useful for our growers. And if we talk about pesticide losses, we're looking at how pesticide formulation and pesticide application influences how pesticides move off-site, and then also how an irrigation event or a rain event after a pesticide application and their intensity actually influences how they're likely to move off-site. And then also amendments that one can put within the substrate to actually keep that active ingredient at the container at the site where it's needed. And then when we talk about remediate, which is actually the area that my lab is most heavily working in, there's a few different types of contaminants that we're looking at. The first is nutrients, because nutrients are great when you're trying to grow the plant, but once you're talking about post-use and within whatever water system that we're dealing with, they often lead to nuisance aquatic weeds, and there can be shifts in pH in the water associated with excessive algae, and it can just be a nuisance to manage. And it can also be, if it's the water is running off-site, an environmental problem. So looking at the technologies, looking at how to remove particulates from water, or whether if we're talking about filter socks, how we can install those on site and what types of sites work. They don't work well on flat sites, but they work well in hilly sites where they don't serve as much as dams. And so floating treatment wetlands is one of the projects that my lab is working on. And we have some really neat results that Lauren will tell you more about on Thursday morning. If we're talking about disease contaminants, which are actually probably the number one concern with most of the growers that we work with, it becomes a problem because they don't know if it's a problem. So they're not willing to recycle water because there might be disease contaminants within that water are propagable to Phytophthora or Pythium. So how do we allay that concern, and how do, if we can allay that concern, is it because we can say, hey, it's not a problem, or it's because we have a technology, a treatment technology that will work to actually remediate the contaminant? And it could also be just, frankly, changing how you water, so you use less water. But it depends on the crops as to whether these work. So we have floating treatment well and vegetated buffer, bioreactors and ozone treatment and other sanitizers. And then if we talk about pesticides, PGRs and herbicides in runoff are a big deal, because if those are applied over time and they begin to concentrate within the water recycling system, you can have potentially sublethal effects of stunting of plants, or sensitive plants might actually have some distortions of tissues or less flowering or smaller flowers, which is not a desirable ornamental trait. So having the capacity to remove that, I think George Grant, Paul Fisher's lab is going to be talking about these on Thursday, and then we can also talk about the use of bioreactors and some other substrates to actually mitigate chlorpyrifos. So all of these technologies work together to actually help solve this problem. And so, and this is where we use them for recycling. And recycling, you know, if we're talking about a greenhouse or a container production area or even a field nursery, there's a lot of different technologies that may work, but all of them may not work equally well for each of those types of operations. So it's determining which technologies actually work well and can we pair them or chain them together to actually get more effect. And then once we can actually get growers to recycle water, is it worth it? Depends how much your water costs. In California, water is very expensive, at least depending upon where you are. Sometimes it's less expensive and more. But Altman Plants, one of the growers that we work with, actually saves about $500,000 a year on water costs, because water costs so much money. After they instituted a water recycling program, they actually also had what we call subsidies, where they actually got grants from NRCS and some other and their water management districts to install these technologies. So it's a big deal. You can save money, and long-term, it's a good investment for them. So regionally, it becomes very critical as to how it works. And then this is an interesting one, because if we talk, and sort of what I've been thinking for a long time was actually proven wrong, because what we thought about this was if we look at a pond, and if you have a treatment chain or a series of ponds, the first pond you put all your dirty water into, and as it moves down that pond cycle, we were thinking that a lot of the disease organisms would become diminished. But if you look at this in the graph, and the y-axis is percent samples with oomycetes, or the presence of Phytophthora propagules in them, and there's 100% in every single one of those ponds. Now, whether they are actually the pathogenic oomycetes or just normal water molds that are nascently within it, it's still there, but we don't know if they're the pathogenic type or not. But once we have treatment before they're used in the greenhouse, those oomycete numbers go down. So this has really caused me to rethink how we've done some of this and to sort of evaluate. But it becomes very important to be able to distinguish between the pathogenic and just the merely present organisms, pathogens. And that it really comes down to, when we look at daisy chaining our treatments together, knowing what your site looks like and being able to individualize treatment recommendations for growers based on their production system. So the use of carbon walls or bioreactors after at running off of areas, which will help with nitrogen and potentially pesticide removal, which David will talk about later. Vegetated channels. Can we actually use vegetated channels to remediate pathogen contaminants? Some of the work in our lab, my lab, suggests that it can. And then just a whole milieu of how do you pair these and daisy chain them together to actually make a system that works for individual growers. And frankly, this probably applies not only to our growers of nursery and greenhouse crops, but any other grower that has irrigation runoff could likely, we could work with them and help them develop treatment technologies that would actually be effective for their water as well. And then again, so we have that overlay of outreach, which is very important. So we're developing these tools to assist growers with decision-making processes. So, and this is really small, I apologize for that, but sort of just to visually, where at an operation are there actually critical control points where if we can actually control a pathogen's present there or diminish their presence, is it most effective to actually have a treatment technology or to remove it? So we're developing a tool and some questionnaires that will actually just be online where they can fill it out. They can fill out a part of it or all of it, and they'll actually begin to be able to assess a level of risk. And we will also provide them with information on what technologies will work based on their situation. It could be just consider performing an irrigation audit and making sure that your water is applied uniformly, because you may have some that are too wet and some that are too dry. But it all depends on just the type of production system, and there will be a series of questions based off one of the questionnaires that Jennifer Park developed. And then it's also critical for us to actually have a good way of getting research output information to our web team. So they developed a form that each of us have to fill out. So, like, I will have to fill out a form when I get back and talk about this talk. Is it research output? I don't know, but it works. And so we'll talk about it, and we'll fill it out and tell where it is and where it might fit. And then a lot of these research outputs actually go into our newsletter. And so we try to do these, I think, about biweekly, every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks. We don't want to inundate our growers or our listserv with a lot of emails. But so we give them, we send out the newsletter. We have about 800 recipients. We always keep trying to expand that. But what we've noticed is that on our website, which is cleanwater3.org, every time we send out a newsletter, we suddenly have big jumps in actually people going to the website. So the newsletter does seem to be working, and there seems to be a bit more name recognition out there in the industry of itself of Clean Water 3. So we think our brand is actually starting to get known out there, which is really good after about 3 years of the project being fully going on board. And it's not just in the U.S. We also have other growers in other countries who are using it, but it is majority the U.S. And we're also, we teamed with the Water Education Alliance for Horticulture to develop our website, because we frankly felt that it was better to actually work with someone else who had a similar focus so that we could expand our impact rather than trying to develop a new website on our own. And it also allows for a latency or continuation of the information after our project is over, because this website will continue to exist after this. But we're doing a redesign of the website so that it is more problem-centric. So if I say I have a problem with my irrigation water, you can click the button that'll say irrigation water, and it'll come up and you'll have a listserv, or I have a problem with the disease, or I have a, whatever your, it's going to be much more grower-friendly than it is researcher-friendly, because we like to parse things out and, you know, sequester them into their own little boxes, and a lot of it is very interwoven within itself. Okay, so that was the part that y'all weren't really interested in. So hopefully this will be the part that you're very interested in. So realistically, so when we put our proposal together, this is how I thought our team would function. And about a year and a half in, we changed it so that outreach was the center and where we were really aiming. And it actually has proven very effective. We also have quarterly conference calls. And it was really hard to kind of figure out where we wanted to be with these. And we sort of digressed as we went along, and we are going to come back to these three slides, which we talk about what we said we'd do, some recent results, and then the activities for the next quarter. So this is kind of what it looks like. We said we're going to do disease inventory loss experiments and learn what happens to Phytophthora. Those were done over time. You can see what has occurred. Hey, you know, we had two crops that actually had much more inventory loss than the others. So what's different about those crops than what we're going to continue to do the next quarter? That has been invaluable. It keeps everybody accountable for what they said they would do. And then the moving forward, it's kept us all up to date with what the other people are doing, which helps us with that overview. We have our annual meeting, which is usually, we have a schedule. We have a day of talks where everybody gets to talk about their projects, a day of tours, then day of grower workshops. So we're really pounding that, get your information out there and get it to the people that can really use it. And then anybody pretty much could come. We're very appreciative of our advisory board time members and really tried, our advisory board members' time, and try to be very conscious of that and use it effectively and well. And if we're in an area where one of our advisory board members is based, any of their growers who would like to come to that, the day of our talks, can also come to that day of talks as well. And that's proven to be effective. And we really shifted from a sort of researcher and advisory board centric meeting to this year, which was, I think, our best meeting yet, to that advisory board centric meeting where advisory board were on board, gung-ho, and actually looking at and saying, hey, this may not work for me, but I can see how it could work for somebody else, which is almost a 180 from where they were a year ago. So it's a good feeling right now with where we are in our project. And we had to go to a detailed agenda, and I limited people to 10 minutes. And boy, did they hate it when I was making them do it. But they liked it at the end. Well, maybe John didn't, but, you know, we'll see. And then we have communication. So we started with conference calls and emails, and then we had some telephone calls occasionally. And then, frankly, they want to be email communication because they're busy people. So if we can communicate with them that way, they can read it on their own time and provide feedback on their own time. And they do. So, and also think about that in webinars terms. If you can parse it out and have 15-minute blocks, they can sit down for 15 minutes and watch something. But if you have it an hour block and they're interested in what's at 45, they're not going to make it there. So really think about how you're delivering information so that they actually get it. Things that I do again, assemble a great team. Hands down, the most important thing you can do with getting one of these projects together, aside from understanding their stakeholders. So we used that planning grant and used it very effectively. And then partner with existing resources. If something exists already that is good, partner with them and make it great. What I do differently, realistically, it's work with my team to emphasize outreach sooner so that we're all on board at the same time. And then earlier integration of our research within the tool development, because we're going to work very hard on that this year. And realistically, communicate big pictures versus details. Because giving the group a vision that they all strive for and want to accomplish is very important. And then that group self-assessment, where are we and where should we be? Are we where we should be, or have we failed somewhere, or did we shift course for good reason? All of these are sort of integral feedback loops that we've integrated recently that have, I think, proved effective and helped us work better together. And I doubt that I have time for questions, but if I do, I don't. Thank you. And
yeah, so we do have time for a quick question or two, Jennifer.
Quarterly. Well, actually, how often do we email our advisory board? We usually do it about every 3 months, and that works, and then we usually have an update where I'll actually provide a concise summary of what we discussed in our quarterly conference calls with the team, so they have an update of where we are, and then usually a really good update before the annual meeting, so they're prepped and ready to go when we have our annual meeting.
Okay, thanks.